Hi, my name is Jim Lewis.
And my name's Chris Painter.
Welcome to Inside Cyber Diplomacy.
Between the two of us, I think we know almost everyone involved in cyber diplomacy. And the idea behind this is really to have frank conversations with those leaders in this area and bring that to the rest of the world, this new area of diplomacy, and talk to these leaders about what's going on.
Our plan is that you'll hear things on this podcast that you're not going to hear anywhere else.
Frank, not scripted, direct conversations. Hope you like it. I know we will.
So please listen in.
Welcome to Inside Cyber Diplomacy. We are exceptionally fortunate today to have Ambassador Guilherme Patriota from Brazil and the chair of the recently concluded and successful group of government experts at the UN. So we will hear his views on the negotiations, on next steps, on what he thinks was good outcomes from the report. With that, let me turn to you, Ambassador, and ask you, now that you're through it, what was your initial reaction to concluding the GGE? I will say that when people began, I, of course, had implicit faith. I think I told you that. But there was a lot of questions. Your predecessor group was unable to reach consensus. You were. So tell us about that.
Well, first of all, I'm very happy to be here and to be talking to you, Jim, and to Chris. I know you follow very closely, and you were important players and participants in previous such negotiations. So it's really an honor to be here speaking with you. My first feeling upon concluding the GGE successfully was of joy, because this GGE version was a longer one. It lasted actually 2.5 years, though we had about 1.5 years worth of work, of actual work. But since the adoption of the resolution in 2018, up until now, about 2.5 years of actual historic time, let's say diplomatic time. And so it's a lengthier period, and I had to program for this longer extended period of negotiation. Meanwhile, the world was changing and progressing very rapidly in the cyber domain. So it's a bit of a challenge, like running a long race, not a sprint. And therefore, the feeling of gratification and joy for the success of the group is that much greater.
Would you say that this is something you'll now treasure in your career in the future? Or are you trying to forget cyber entirely and move on?
Oh, no, definitely. This is one of the great moments that diplomacy offers to someone like me. I'm a career diplomat for about 35 years. And I've had other such epiphanies in my career, moments where you see things fall into place and where agreement is really something of great value that you treasure for your life. And that's one of the great moments, but I had a couple of other moments. So this will be up there with these other moments. I will not mention the other ones because maybe they will be as considered as interesting to you. But
I was going to ask you about that because you, of course, are one of the things that I think helped you, in my view, and I think in the view of Under Secretary General Nakamitsu, is you had tremendous experience in Geneva with some arms control issues. So how useful was that in shaping the GGE?
Well, I think the whole length of my career was useful because, you know, diplomacy is accumulated actual experience more than anything else. It's not something you really learn in textbooks. So I've done a lot of multilateral stuff throughout my career, almost 30 plus years of that. But of course, disarmament, Geneva did help me out with disarmament issues. So though I've been doing technology negotiations for quite a while, I started off in science and technology division of the ministry. I was there for WISIS process, which is the Information Society Summit process. I was in the PREPCOMS there for 2001, 2002, 2003. And I did a lot of that. I had a lengthy experience with intellectual property negotiations, both at WIPO, then in the WTO. So I was always very interested in the technology side of diplomacy, having studied biology myself before entering the diplomatic service. So For me, it's an accumulation of experiences that helps, I think, because I'm not a cyber expert per se as such. It's an issue of getting people together, of being perceptive of each expert's sensitivities, you know, being able to understand where the red lines lie and where middle ground can be found, and trying to find the right language and the right timing and things like that. I think that's very helpful. In Geneva, I did the PAROS GGE, which was the Preventing an Arms Race in Outer Space GGE. It was a shorter one to this, and it was held under very different conditions because it was a very hard mandate. You know, the mandate was to provide elements for a treaty, and some parties really did not want a treaty. So it was almost born with a bit of a paradox contained inside its own mandate. So we went as far as we could with that one. I also had an outer space discussion in the Conference on Disarmament, which is considered a venue where you never achieve consensus. But I managed to pull off a rare report on precisely outer space. It was a consensus report adopted by the conference, a rare moment as well. And then other activities, perhaps less to the liking of the powerful countries, like the ban treaty, the nuclear weapons ban treaty, was also a high moment in my career because I feel I did contribute quite a lot to the success of those negotiations back in 2017. And then ICANN, the NGO that promoted this idea, supported us, won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2017. So I felt I owned at least 1% of that Nobel Peace Prize should have gone to me as a negotiator from Brazil, very active. So those are small successes that you keep, you know, in your treasure chest throughout your career. The SDGs was another moment. I was very, very engaged, and it was a collective exercise, but I took part in that. And Brazil was an important partner because a lot of it came out of the Rio Plus 20 conference. You know, the Future We Want document was the basis for that. So I was the main negotiator from Brazil doing the SDGs. That was a huge moment. And other times when we pushed through the agenda for development at WIPO in intellectual property, usually many countries don't want to talk about development. They want to talk about protecting the property on technologies. So that was a bit of a breakthrough too. And I had a lot to do with that. And smaller moments such as those, they were great moments. But I must say this GGE was, in recent years, it was special. And I think it's very relevant. It's a small step, let's say, when you look at it substantively. But I think it has a lot of significance in terms of how the world is shaping up for the future. And I think the future of diplomacy will have a lot to do with these kinds of negotiations, you know, trying to translate commitments, obligations, mutual understandings among states into the cyber realm, because now everything is cyber, everything is virtual. And you can't just transpose agreements that were produced for the analog world into cyber directly. I think a kind of a new understanding needs to be, you know, developed, and you have to deepen these understandings. So we took initial steps with the previous GGEs. I think the 2015 one was a real game changer. It was very important. And those norms are not binding, but they were picked up by everyone throughout the world. And in this GGE iteration, I was mandated to hold some regional meetings with regions of the world in the Americas, in Africa, and the Asian region, the EU, the OSCE. Amazed to see that all the work they were doing were based on the 2015 report and the 11 norms of responsible state behavior that were adopted then. So to be now in a position to add to that agreement 5-6 years later, I think it's an important step, you know, and we did it in a manner that is very thoughtful, and it was negotiated in great detail. So what you will read in the report is not something that was, you know, hurriedly pushed from the chair by the chair. It's something that was actually quite negotiated in a lot of detail. We went through that text 3-4 times. Everyone had the chance to refine the language to an incredible extent. Of course, you can't do that forever. At some point, you need to stop and get to the red lines and see if you can reach an agreement. But that text, we had a lot of drafting and a lot of going through it over and over again. So I think To me, it's a valuable text in that sense.
The 2015 report, which I know really well, was also chaired by a Brazilian. And in many ways, Carlos was responsible in some ways. He held the clock. I remember that. We were supposed to end at 6 on Friday, did not have agreement. He held the clock. So that will be one moment I always remember. Did you consult with him? Did you get his advice, or did you talk to him before or after the process? I got the impression that he never wanted to hear the word cyber again. But he
sent me a congratulation message. So that was more or less as much as we spoke to each other. I think he had moved on. He was very pleased to have achieved that great landmark decision. I think that was his moment. We worked together. He worked with me in New York for a couple of years. So we know each other quite well. And in fact, I was in many ways responsible for him being the designated Brazilian expert in 2014, 15, and for convincing him to accept the chairmanship of that particular GGE, because he felt slightly uncomfortable, as he was not a real cyber expert. But I told him that I encouraged him and supported him then. And he did a great job. So we don't really have to speak to each other. We come from the same sort of background and formed under the same Brazilian diplomatic, a multilateral kind of experience, which I think it's quite good and recognized. Yeah. And then he went on to do other things. But I'm sure he has that as one of his great achievements. And I, in fact, was worried that I would not meet up to his standards, would not rise to his standards. It would look really bad if I didn't get a successful outcome.
I was a little worried about that too. So
there was a lot at play there.
maybe the lesson here is the Brazilian should always cheer the GG. That seems to be the good outcome. And I guess it made it harder for you to say no when you were elected the chair. If you convinced him, he should take that job. So.
If I can be a little bit transparent, in fact, I was a bit quite honored because from the beginning, I was not meant to be necessarily the Brazilian designated expert. But as some of the important other experts knew my work from Geneva and elsewhere, I learned that they would find my name an acceptable name, impartial enough. And so also there was an issue of level, because this GGE was not only was it lengthier, it was also held at a slightly higher level, I think, than previous ones. Many were ambassadors and senior figures from representing not their governments. They were there in their personal capacity, but they were senior level experts. So it was important to have, let's say, an ambassador as a chair. That was also one of the considerations. And Brazil and me, we were considered at least impartial enough to be acceptable to the different parties who were there.
Well, I want to dig into the report in a bit, but there's one thing that we were talking about a little earlier, which is that, you know, this was also unique. And at the same time you were having the GGE, your colleague, Ambassador Lauber, was chairing the open-ended working group. And they pretty much ran in parallel. They did, you know, mostly they overlapped. And I guess one question is, you know, when that reached conclusion, successful conclusion, which again, as Jim said, many people didn't think that would happen. Did that make you more hopeful that yours would also reach that same conclusion, or a little worried that it would, because, you know, people got what they wanted out of the OEWG, and so they were just ready to express their differences. I think many people were even more surprised that you were able to come to the conclusion after that.
Well, there's a longer answer to that, but from the beginning, Ambassador Lauber and myself, we try to form what was initially perceived as something not that positive, which was the fact of having two separate processes running parallel to each other, dealing with the same issue, one involving the full membership of the UN, the other one, 25 experts in their personal capacity as GGEs go. So we tried to unite the two chairs. We got along very, very well. And to transform this negative setting, let's say, setup, into something positive. So we made a lot of effort to find convergence and to make sure that the processes would both progress at a good rhythm, a good speed, producing positive outcomes that would not run counter to each other. That was the main concern. I think In many ways, naturally, the OEWG, Ambassador Lauber's group, would produce something slightly different because it's a formal session of all UN members, 193 there, more political in nature, people writing and reading statements. Delegations there were in their formal capacities as representatives of government. You know, in my case, it's not open to the public. It's informal. We are experts, closed sessions. Only 25 of us, we can really get into details if we want to. And then there was the paradox of the COVID-19 pandemic, which in fact doubled the amount of time we had available to perform work, counter to what one would think. The fact that we all accepted to do a lot of virtual work made us do twice the amount of work that we would otherwise have done if it was only in-presence sessions and we had to travel all the way to Geneva or New York. So that was also useful. When, in my view, the positive outcome of the OEWG was a necessary step to achieve an outcome in the GGE. But once the outcome was reached in the OEWG, then a lot of pressure was put on me. I felt a lot of pressure, and I think the adrenaline increased on my side because now it was up to me not to fumble, not to, you know, let the opportunity slip, go by, to have something equally relevant. If there was a negative outcome in the OEWG, then I think the chances for an outcome in the GGE would have been close to nil. So I think it was, you know, this was a requirement to have that positive step. So Ambassador Lauber took that first step. He made his decisions based on the reality of his process. And I think he did incredibly well. He had two different reports. One is the consensus report. The other one is a chair summary. Now the consensus report is also part of what I call the acquis. It's together with the previous GGE reports is now, it's meant to be read together. And I don't think there's anything there that would contradict or be inconsistent with what we have adopted in the GGE now. And our GGE report is different in nature. It's more specific. It addresses the 11 norms per se. You know, it goes through each and every one of them. So it's different outcome. One or the other thing will be similar, of course, you know, as to future work, for example, we kind of both point in the same direction. It couldn't be any different. We wouldn't be pointing, you know, across each other. But yes, it was necessary for the OEWG to achieve success, for the GG to conclude its work on a positive note.
One of the issues that's always dogged all of these discussions and made them difficult is the issue of the role of international law in this context. And you actually got a fair amount of text on it. Early on in the process, I spoke to the Chinese expert, and he was a bit negative on international law. And yet you seem to have dodged that bullet. Happened there?
Yeah, and even more than that, that language about international humanitarian law, which, you know, for people, if you're outside these discussions, people were like, well, why is that a big deal? But every time that was a big hanging point, and it seems got, you know, at least some language on that, which hadn't been expressly mentioned before.
Well, I don't feel I can really reveal, you know, each expert's hands. I also don't have their instructions. You know, I can only work on the basis of things that they tell me and that I hear during the course of discussions. But I think one of the things that I tried to do for the good or for the bad was to keep a lot of the elements on the table until the very last end. So because also we had a lot of time to refine language, so I was confident that, you know, even though we had a lengthy text, we had run through it 3-4 times collectively. So I was pretty sure that most of the difficulties had been, you know, refined and adapted to the limits of each expert in the process. So that was, I think, very helpful that we had a lot of time to work through that language. And there was some options, let's say, to cut some bits, off that text to make it perhaps easier to adopt. And the international law section would have been, you know, the obvious candidate for that, because I was getting some feedback on that particular chapter that it might be a very difficult area to get agreement on. And it was one of the reasons why the 2017 GGE failed, I understand. And international law is very difficult because, in fact, we're discussing cyber security, but then all of a sudden you need a very experienced international law people to actually address certain aspects of how international law does apply, not only in cyberspace, but anywhere. Elements of the UN Charter regarding the right to self-defense, what is an armed attack, and things like that. Those are not simple issues, whatever the discussion, you know, and less so when you're trying to transpose all this into a new virtual world, kind of borderless, and how to deal with these things. So very, very complex. You have to acknowledge that it is complex and difficult. So I think we went carefully. I did not present a shortened or abridged version of the draft final report to facilitate things. I kept all issues there. We had, for all issues on the table coming from previous GGs, we had language and we had something about said about them in the report. And in the end, I think there was a coming together of sorts, almost spontaneously, because the will was there not to make the report fall apart. And it was so balanced. There was so much investment in all the sections that I think even those not too pleased with the international law made that extra effort to find, you know, to eliminate some of the things that were red lines for them and to try to be cooperative. So we had a spirit of cooperation in the final stretch. That was the uncertainty for me. You know, it could have gone wrong, but I think in the end, they all rose to the occasion. And also because there was positive agreement in the OEWG, I think some countries felt they needed a symmetric, you know, equally successful outcome. Otherwise, it would have been very bad for the future discussions on this.
Were there any moments when you felt like things, because it was a very long process, any moments when you felt like things were going the wrong direction? What were the chief obstacles on the international law? Was there ever that moment where you thought, well, that's it?
There were a couple of moments I felt a little bit discouraged, also because I changed my portfolio mid-course. So I was no longer doing disarmament. I'm here in Mumbai doing, you know, as the consul general, doing trade promotion, consular things. And distant from the realities of disarmament negotiations all of a sudden, but keeping this thing as a responsibility. Mm-hmm. So, well, I never felt we were in the wrong direction in terms of my convictions as to what we could do and what we should do. So I set that out in the beginning. I tried, first of all, you were there, Jim, I tried to lower ambition a bit because, you know, I knew we were resuming work from a negative or traumatic experience of the 2017, where people invested a lot in that exercise. And then at the end, there was no report, it failed, no consensus. So I thought, you know, maybe we should reduce a little bit ambition and start very carefully. So that's when I said, you know, and we all agreed that, first of all, we would fully respect the acquis. There would be backward compatibility with everything that was done before. Let's not negate, you know, what we managed to agree in 2010, 2013, 2015. That's untouchable, it's sacred. And then we try to build another layer of common understanding on the basis of that, not necessarily new things. We don't want to scare countries who are weary of, you know, all of a sudden adding completely new norms or agreements on top of that. They don't want to take that leap, but they do want to deepen the norms and they want to broaden the understanding, because the 2015 report has the norms, but they're kind of very abridged. They're very short paragraphs. Those who negotiated it knows what it means, but for countries who were not there, it's hard to interpret. So we thought it would be useful to provide the world with additional guidance and interpretation, what they mean, what's the value of the norms, why they're important, you know, and what things you could do to better implement them, even mechanism, national strategies, international cooperation, all sorts of things. So by diminishing a little bit the ambition and having this idea of the layer, I think we managed to pull it off. Of course, some experts didn't necessarily like that approach. They wanted the big leap. They wanted perhaps to discuss, now it's time for a treaty. Now it's time for a diplomatic conference. Now I want legally binding provisions. I want something more typically along the lines of a disarmament treaty, you know, because some countries look at things in from a disarmament perspective. That's where they come from. And, you know, whether it's cyber, outer space, or nuclear weapons, you know, the tradition in disarmament is to have these very rigidly constructed legally binding treaties. If you want to be serious about these things, you have to bind yourself. But cyber is a new reality. It's fast-paced. Everything changes. You know, these older treaties took, some of them took more than 10 years to be negotiated. You can't spend 10 years negotiating things in the cyber realm. So, you know, to me, it makes sense to have the norms. They're voluntary, but they're very valuable because if they make sense, that's what everyone has. You know, the common reference are the norms. That's what you have. It was agreed. They were agreed.
Having a close relationship with the 2015 norms, I don't think you diluted any of them. No. You know, my favorite, no attacks on critical infrastructure contrary to international obligations. I was worried about how that one would turn out. But it seems that, you know, you have pretty much deepened the explanations and the understanding and didn't really dilute anything, although I know there were at least a few people in the room who were interested in that. So how did you keep them on course?
The substance didn't really come from me. I'm the facilitator. Of course, I think you can draw better substance when it comes from the countries that feel greater ownership of the process. And, you know, now this particular process now, I think there's a feeling of ownership from those countries who are more supportive of the non-binding voluntary norms kind of approach and building up on that. And some of those countries took the leadership. You know, when I, first of all, I opened up for everyone to contribute with substance. Okay, so we had about 150 pages of a matrix that we drew up out of all the experts' contributions. So we went through that process. We open up, we get everyone to pitch in, you know, and what are the norms for you? What are their values? And we got a lot of great contributions and we use that. And then it's a matter of, you know, going through all those contributions and figuring out what are the ones that would make it, what are the ones that sound reasonable. You end up with a lot of repetition. So then you've got to eliminate repetition. You've got to merge language. Some things aren't the norms, but they refer to international law, you know, where you place them. Can you place them in the international law? Some comments on a particular norm, they seem to be universal in nature. So maybe you should put them in the chapeau and not keep it in the norm as such, because they apply to all of the norms, not just that one. And all that thing, you know, that's what you do. It's typical sort of multilateral diplomacy to do this and try to find the best possible outcome. The greatest challenge was perhaps some participants taking long to address what was on the table. So that left to me a big question mark, you know, will I make it? When we come to crunch time, will I make it? Will this particular participant decide to actually look at the text and comment the specificities of the text instead of questioning the approach of the text or of the process? You know, and that came late. So, but I knew it would happen. And so one of the challenges is you had to keep the door open for the latecomers, those who would adhere to actual specific negotiations on the text at a later stage because of tactical reasons, perhaps also because they wanted to find out what would happen first with the OEWG before committing to engaging on specificities of the GGE. So we had to keep that door open. And fortunately, there was also, I think, a level of understanding from the other participants that was a necessary step for success. You know, so they had to accept that a large number of participants, they rallied around, they read the thing, they put all their views very clearly and they drafted collectively and all this, while a couple others held back a bit. And then closer to the end, the ones who held back, all of a sudden they had to be brought in. So that was, you know, the last tier of negotiation, the big final step.
Back to international law thing for a second. Did it help you that the way this GG was constructed, the mandate was that countries could submit voluntarily their views on international law? So in other words, there was a little bit of a, you know, a mattress laid. So you didn't have to make as much progress because people could contribute these things by design. And that was, I think, to address some of the 2017 issues. Was that helpful or did that not come up as much?
It was both helpful and unhelpful. it was helpful because it did provide a release of tension. You know, if you had a lot to say about how international law applies to states' use of ICTs, because I think that's the formulation. We're not saying that it applies to cyberspace. We're saying it applies to the use by states of ICTs. So if you have a lot to say about that and you do want to say it, you don't have to put all your eggs on the report itself. So you try to fit things in the report that will be agreed upon, and then everything that is not agreeable or that is very uniquely yours, you can, you know, put on a piece of paper and it becomes an annex to the report. But what I did not foresee, and I think others also did not foresee, was that there would be questions raised about the existence of an annex to the report as per the mandate, because the mandate was drafted very clearly. There's no question that it guides us to do it in such a fashion, to have that annex there. But then all of a sudden, you know, countries come up with questions, you know, what would be the status of this annex? If the annex is, you know, it's a part of the report, and after it's done, we send it over, the Secretary General sends it over to the General Assembly, it welcomes the report, then what is the status of the annex? And the annex contains a lot of things that are unilateral in nature. They are views from different states as to how they see things like attribution, for example, a very sensitive discussion, you know, how to attribute an incident to a particular state if you're the victim of that malicious act or that ICT incident. So that's a very sensitive issue. A lengthy discussion happened on that. And then you have 3, 4, 5 different views on that attached to the report. And that becomes, is it part of the report? Is it part of the substance? If it's welcomed by the General Assembly, what's the status of this? So we started to have all that discussion. It was not a simple discussion. I couldn't clarify it 100%. And then there was an issue, always a bit of trust or people coming from different perspectives. And it facilitated things because people were less stressed out that they had to put everything in the report itself. They could do it in a separate piece of paper. It becomes an annex. Then there was the issue of, we don't like the annex. The annex cannot exist. You know, it will gain some kind of a legal status of sorts, and that will pose problems because you're going to have different views, and countries can claim that these views were kind of endorsed by the UN or something like that. So we had to. It was one of the difficult points, I must say. It was a new element in the mandate there. Helpful, yes, but then in the end, it became one of the difficult issues to clarify and sort out.
In designing the mandate, I think we saw it as an escape valve.
Yeah.
You know, that since IL had blown up 2017.
That was clearly the original intent, yes.
Yeah. We thought it would be the chairman sending it, and so therefore that would determine its status.
I think there's an elegant treatment of that particular part of the mandate. So everyone is in agreement. Everyone is satisfied that we achieved that. So we have a compilation. It has a formal official number you can refer to. It will be up on, you notice, the UN Secretariat's website alongside, let's say, the report of the GGE. So it's going to be made available, and it will have a reference number that you can refer to. And it also, I think, appeases those countries that were a little bit concerned about this having some kind of a legal status. In the end, we managed to overcome the difficulties there. But if that was not solved, it could have been a make or break issue, let's say. So that's why, I don't think it was that easy.
Having done a little in designing the mandate, we didn't foresee that as an issue, in part, I thought, because it would be the chairman sending it and not necessarily representative of the group.
And so I think it was.
You dodged that bullet on your own.
And it was designed as a relief valve. But there were a lot of things going on, obviously, also when you're writing a report, a lot of tensions, particularly between certain countries in the GGE. And you know, you look at the norms and the explanation of the norms, the further explanation you did. And some of them are interesting. And I think people are beginning to talk about them even now. So you have this spate of ransomware attacks, for instance, that are coming from the territory of a state, whether they're state controlled or not. And a lot of the language about responsibility of states for actions in their territory are actually beginning to be cited, even from this report now, to deal with state responsibility. when you had these negotiations, were people talking about some of the current events, or was that sort of put in a bubble and you were really talking more in terms of the norms themselves without getting into any of the geopolitical current issues that were happening?
I think the current events were informing a lot of what was being brought from experts, but we didn't really discuss it as such. There was no actual discussion of current events. I think that was on the back of people's mind when they were discussing text. But I think it was like broader. You know, we cannot dwell on each incident. We don't want to really have an expose, you know, of the intricacies of this particular cyber attack here or there. I think there was an interest in getting general norms and general understandings done among all the participants. And even the more detailed technological aspects of these things were not really discussed in the context. It was a more of a diplomatic exercise, a lot of drafting and general concepts being tested and proposed and improved and so on.
What are your expectations for moving ahead? We now have the eternal OEWG, or I guess 5 years. We have the program of action. I don't know if there will be another GGE. It's possible, but I know many countries would prefer one process, and we already have two. What are your expectations, drawing on your experience now as chair?
Myself and even my own government, we were not unfavorable to another GGE. We think, but the formula seems for the moment seems to have exhausted itself, because now there's a five-year-long OEWG already being set up, and then you have a proposal from another group of countries of a program of action that could become a process in its own right for the future. So I wouldn't dare suggest, you know, another GGE would be useful, but there would be material for that. For example, just the issue of attribution could be the subject matter of another GGE, you know. And again, GGEs are advisory committees to the Secretary General of the UN. So yeah, they're not meant to replace member states' decision-making bodies. They're meant to advise the Secretary General on new challenging issues that are emerging and that countries find it a bit difficult to get agreement on, because the GGE format is more informal. It allows you to test each other's limits of positions, because nothing that you say will be made public or will be written in stone. So you have freedom to talk to each other within a GGE, and you're not the full 193. So you can actually have a more dynamic back and forth interactive discussion. I think no more GGEs for the time being on cyber.
Become a sort of quantum negotiation, a substitute for actual negotiation. You might have been the last one to have to do that.
Maybe. I think it's possible. All the eyes now are all set on the new OEWG. They had their organizational session and 5 years. Each year produces, I think, a kind of a preliminary report. And then you have a final report at the fifth year. That will be 2025. And the program of action can be discussed within the OEWG and elsewhere. So it all depends what countries will do with that. I think now those are the two alternatives that we have. And then regionally, you will have a lot of action. Regions will do things, possibly more around the cooperation sort of thing, confidence building and stuff like that.
Yeah, I was going to turn to that. One of the things in the report that you seems to be a low-hanging fruit that everyone agreed to is the importance of implementation, the importance of capacity building. You have a background, as you said, in being Brazil's negotiator on the development agenda. Do the cyber capacity building issues need to be embraced as part of that larger development agenda, instead of being something that's kind of often been treated as a, you know, separate boutique area? Do we need to kind of bring those things together to mainstream that? And what do you see as the kind of barriers?
Again, it's a yes and no response to your comment, because one thing I didn't mention when you spoke before is that everything we did is under the peace and security lens,
right,
umbrella. So it's a peace and security discussion. The mandates come from the first committee of the General Assembly, which discusses matters of interest to peace and security. So everything is discussed. You discuss human rights, freedom of expression, privacy. You discuss some criminal activities, terrorism in cyberspace, so on and so forth. But the focal point, the matter of greatest concern, are the things that could pose a threat to peace, to international peace. And that filters off a lot of things. And also explains when you mentioned the not letting your territory be used by other actors, to promote malicious ICT activities. Mm-hmm. It was clear to all of us that what we were discussing was foremost a state-on-state type of issues, because we're discussing peace and security, and that's states' responsibilities. Of course, in the report, you do have references to other kinds of stakeholders, to non-state or other actors that are not state actors. But states are called to action. They are called to take on responsibilities, because this is a state-on-state discussion, basically. We are not discussing human rights per se. We're not discussing terrorism per se. We're not discussing criminal cyber activities per se. It's peace and security. So that's the nature of the discussion, and it means it translates into this a little bit, in a way, a bad analogy with the space, outer space discussions. In outer space, everything that happens in space is attributable and the responsibility of a state. Even if it's a private company that sends something out there, if something goes wrong, it's the responsibility of a state. It has been like that from the beginning regarding outer space. When you're discussing peace and security in the cyber world, to a certain degree, states are the ultimate responsible entities here. The norms are for states. It's responsible state behavior. But of course, part of your responsibility is to make sure others don't ruin things and don't pose a threat to peace. If this other actor is not a state actor, you have to also do something. You cannot just wash your hands and it's a private entity, so I have nothing to do with this. He can continue to do whatever he wants. No, he cannot, because that can pose a threat to peace and security if he does it at a certain level in a certain way.
As you can imagine, that particular norm from 2015 is the subject of some attention here in Washington at the moment.
Now.
So we'll see what we get. We've taken up quite a bit of your time. I mean, was there anything that we should have covered and didn't? Is there any final thoughts you'd have to say, like to add to this? Chris, I don't know if you have any final questions.
I mean, basically that same kind of wrap-up question, in terms of, are you optimistic we're going to continue to make progress? One thing the report, neither the OEWG or this report dealt with much is, the accountability piece. It's great to have these understandings, these voluntary norms, et cetera, but you still see every day transgressions. And so how can you, without being escalatory, how can you actually, or even being escalatory, how do you actually make sure there's more compliance than we have now? So do you see any progress? It's a hard thing to make progress in, because it includes attribution, all those other tough issues. But do you see us making progress on that in the next couple of years, or is that just going to be a continuing problem?
Well, I think it's going to be a long-term issue, and we're just beginning to scratch the surface. One step in 2015, I think another step now. We're going to have to take many more steps and reach many more agreements and understandings. The technology is there, and incidents will happen. Probably that was also part of the assessment in the report. They're becoming more serious, they're becoming more frequent, they're becoming more severe, and they will not stop just because we have a GGE report. So that's the reality of it. But I think the report is a helpful step to get greater common agreement and avoid at least misperceptions among states, so that they respond in manners that are slightly less conducive to aggression or undesirable conflict. There's a lot of emphasis in the report on the settlement of disputes by peaceful means, for example, and consultative processes. Before you respond to something, consult the other country. Even if an incident is coming from a particular territory, you should notify that state that, the incident is coming from him. The state should acknowledge your notification. So baby steps, but important ones, because we're encouraging the establishment of a network of communications that is up to speed for the cyber reality. You know, the countries have these national computer emergency response team and or incident computer incident response team and things like that. So there's an encouragement to form networks of those that they can have channels to communicate directly amongst themselves, also at the diplomatic level, at all levels, at the political, diplomatic, at the legal aspects of these. So we're trying to build something that could alleviate the prospect for incidents to scale up and provoke conflict in ways that nobody wants, that would be detrimental to the international order. Of course, you cannot control what goes on, and countries do what they have to do. They take their decisions. There's an element here of also geopolitical intentions. There's the military use of ICTs, which is recognized in the report in a particular moment there in the text. You cannot close your eyes and make believe these things are not there, they're not happening. But I think what you can do, you know, what diplomacy can do is to establish some common rules of the game. And that's what we're trying to do. I think we did what we could for the time being. More can be done for the future. I hope this OEWG or the Program of Action will establish, you know, a better system for dialogue and for releasing the tensions that will inevitably occur. Because often when you can do something or when something is materially possible, someone will do it. So, you know, the technology is an enabler of things. If you can't do it, someone might do it. Because now it's materially possible to do certain things and in an anonymous manner, which raises the challenge now. You know, it's not obvious for others who's doing what, because the cyber world is a fluid world and we all depend on that. A lot of emphasis was in the report as to the higher degree of dependency on networks and, you know, the Internet of Things. Now, how all this raises the stake in terms of security, because it's an enabler for development and a lot of good things that we want, but it also increases the attack surface. It raises vulnerability. And one thing in everybody's mind was the COVID-19 pandemic and the health critical infrastructure behind health services, for example, how that, if you attack that, for example, how that could lead to a humanitarian catastrophe of great proportions and possibly lead to conflict, you know, because it's such an important thing. And we try to suggest, you know, things that should be protected in terms of critical infrastructure in a manner that is more clearly than in the 2015 report. So health is there, you know, water is there, water and sanitation, electrical grid is there, electricity, energy. And another area that you didn't mention, but which also required, I think, a lot of refinement was the supply chain integrity aspect of these discussions, because that has also correlates with something very concrete in today's world. You know, the discussions about the reliability of supply chain and ensuring that consumers have confidence in all the elements of that supply chain that they use. And how do you build the trust and how do you increase confidence? A discussion about, for example, common standards and going that direction. But when you build common standards, you should not discriminate this and that technology and so on and so forth. So very, very difficult balances to be achieved, but there's something there. So very happy that we managed to get that agreement. And if I can say my last comment would be that what made me happiest is that I did not have to hold time, Jim, as was the case in 2015. I actually ended the GGE one session earlier than necessary. And I had the great satisfaction of gaveling a report that everyone indicated was very happy with. So no complaints. And that was kind of my goal in terms of success, you know, that I could gavel a report that I would not have to gavel imposing myself upon anyone, that all would be happy with it. And that's what happened. They were all happy with it. I know they didn't get everything they wanted. No one did, but I had no complaints and I did not have to make use of force, let's say, to get that report adopted. It was a joint and people were celebrating, and everyone was equally happy. So to me, that was the greatest of all achievements.
No, well, considerable success. And we've taken up enough of your time, Ambassador Patriota. Thank you for what I found to be an exceptionally valuable lesson in how to negotiate and how to negotiate the things in cyber. So with that, Chris, I don't know if you have any final words.
I'd say you should be rightly proud, and I hope that you stay in the cyber club in your future endeavors, because you certainly are very talented and you have a lot of background, I think, that's useful in this, and it's proved to be. And just to your point about people celebrating, it's a rare UN report where you have the US lead, Michelle Markov, off actually thanking her Russian and Chinese counterparts for being able to come to a consensus on Twitter. So that I think, if nothing else, that's an indication that you got everyone, you got them happy. And that's a big achievement and a hard one given the expectations.
I would be remiss if I didn't mention the quality of the support team. So I had the best support team possible. Jim was part of it. Then up to a certain point, I think you had other responsibilities to attend. But you started off with us, and the support team with Kirsten Vineyard, Jillian Goh, and Camino Kavanaugh, and Ingmar Sabli, they were great people. They had done previous GGEs, a lot of knowledge, a lot of, you know, good perceptions as to what kind of language would fly, would not fly. So I think a lot of the merit for the good drafting goes to them, not to me. So the support team was wonderful. And I'm also very indebted to the High Representative for Disarmament Affairs, Under Secretary General Izumi Nakamitsu. So if I can also make this special word of gratitude here to her, because it was kind of her idea to put me on the spot on this GGE. She had a lot of thrust, and she had the conviction that both myself and Ambassador Lauber could deliver an adopted report on both ends, and she proved to be right. So I really think she deserves a lot of praise in that respect.
Great. Congratulations again, and thank you for doing this interview.
Thank you both.
This podcast is made possible by the generous support of the Cybersecurity Agency of Singapore and the Estonian Ministry of Foreign Affairs.